This is CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. And now, a BBC World Service update.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Ukraine's new president, the billionaire confectionery tycoon Petro Poroshenko, has been sworn in at a ceremony in the capital Kiev. Mr. Poroshenko said he would work towards making Ukraine a full member of the European Union.
We're standing with our feet and heart in Ukraine. We keep our heads in Europe. That's what Mikhail Dragomanov said. The return of Ukraine to its natural European condition had been a dream of many generations. The dictatorship that reigned in the past years in Ukraine was willing to isolate us from this prospect.
The BBC's David Stern in Kiev listened to Mr. Poroshenko's inaugural address.
In his speech, Mr. Poroshenko offered an amnesty to separatists in the east if they laid down their weapons and a corridor to Russian fighters to leave Ukraine. But he ruled out any separatism and said Ukraine would remain a unified country. And though he said he would protect the use of the Russian language, he said Ukrainian would remain the country's sole official language. Mr. Poroshenko said he will travel soon to the eastern regions and that he would go there in peace.
Police in Sao Paulo have used tear gas to break up protests on the second day of a metro strike that's caused traffic chaos in Brazil's largest city. Nearly half of the metro stations were closed. Sao Paulo will host the opening match of the Football World Cup next Thursday. From there, Katie Watson reports.
It's days away from kickoff, and the feeling here is one of frustration rather than festivity. A second day of strikes by the city's metro workers turned violent on Friday. At one point, clashes broke out between picketing strikers and military police. Several rounds of negotiations have now failed, and workers remain on indefinite strike. The traffic here on a good day is dreadful, but with a third of metro stations closed, it was made even worse, with more than 200 kilometres of traffic jams. If there's no resolution by June the 12th, it's a fate that tens of thousands of fans may have to experience too.
Officials in Afghanistan say more than 50 people have been killed in flash flooding in the remote mountainous northeast of the country. A police officer in the province of Baghlan said dozens were still missing after torrential rains. The floods have washed away hundreds of homes and forced thousands of people to flee. A spokesman for the army said two helicopters had been sent to the area to provide assistance. Rising sea levels around the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean have washed the remains of Second World War soldiers from their graves. Speaking at United Nations climate talks in Germany, the island's foreign minister, Tony de Broome, said high tides had exposed the skeletons of 26 people believed to be Japanese soldiers. He called for urgent action. World news from the BBC. An anti-corruption investigation in China has revealed that more than 1,000 officials in the southern province of Guangdong have wives or children living abroad. China's communist leadership is trying to stamp out the practice in the belief that it's linked to corruption. Many officials funnel illegally obtained funds to relatives outside the country. These civil servants are known as naked officials because they appear to have few assets at home. Thailand's military rulers have lifted a curfew at four tourist destinations to encourage foreigners to continue visiting the country, despite ongoing political uncertainty. The ruling means that famous all-night parties on the southern island of Pangan will again take place this month. The parties draw thousands of overseas tourists. Thailand's army staged a coup 2 weeks ago and now runs the country. An 89-year-old British Second World War veteran has returned to his care home after having disappeared to make his own way to Normandy for the commemorations of the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Bernard Jordan had been reported missing on Thursday, but was later found to be safe and well in northern France. Mr. Jordan told Britain's ITV News that he was becoming quite a regular at the ceremonies.
I've been here last year, and I've been here obviously this time, and I'm going to touch wood if I'm still with us. And I'll be 91 then, but if I'm still about, I should try it next few years.
So nothing's going to stop you, basically?
Oh, no.
The owners of his care home say Mr. Jordan is now looking forward to having a rest and a cup of tea. The US Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, has opened its first official accounts on Twitter and Facebook, saying it hopes to engage more directly with the public. The spy agency's first message on Twitter suggests a sense of humour. It reads, "We can neither confirm nor deny that this is our first tweet." And that's the latest BBC News.
This is Sports Hour with me, Caroline Barker, an hour dedicated to behind the week in sport. Coming up, what's to fear from rowing across an ocean alone?
The first of everything, so the first big storm and the first few nights at sea in the dark by myself with this very, very deep ocean. It's a challenge that I've just wanted to do for a long time, and it's really hard to explain. When I first heard of ocean rowing, I just thought, I want to do that one day.
Elsa Hammond on taking part in the race across the Pacific. Plus, on this week's Sporting Witness, 25 years on from the Tiananmen Square massacre, we hear from Michael Chang, whose victory in the French Tennis Open happened in the same week. And Canada's Commonwealth cyclist, whose story is sure to inspire anyone carrying a few extra pounds.
Well, it started as a way to lose weight, I think. I was approaching my 30th birthday, and I was very unfit and not feeling very good about myself. So I got on a rail bike and then just got stronger and found a competitive side.
This is Sports Hour, a unique look at the world of sports and beyond. But first, football's World Cup gets underway in Brazil in just a few days' time. For many, it's the most important cultural event on the planet. Its impact felt socially and politically way beyond the football field, into families, communities and governments. Over the next 20 minutes or so, we'll hear from some of the most significant characters and those stories that show the World Cup's influence across the globe. Joining me to discuss all things World Cup, Professor Matthew Taylor, Acting Director of the International Centre for Sports History and Culture at De Montfort University in the UK. And the first World Cup, might as well start there, back in 1930. To what extent was world sport global before that?
Well, I think we sometimes forget the extent to which modern sport spread during a kind of first wave of globalisation in the late 19th and early 20th century. This was a world of kind of increasing capitalist global economy, new communication networks. People were connected more than they ever had been before in many ways. And there were a lot of kind of early global sports. Boxing was probably the most globalised sport. Boxers moved around the world and big fights were carried across the globe via newspapers and films of the fights. There were also lots of cricket, rugby and football tours. The famous Corinthians team from England toured regularly, and these tours crisscrossed the globe in the two decades before the First World War. The Olympics was probably most significant of all. It was connected to the early imperial exhibitions and world fairs, and the football tournaments at the Olympics were really popular, particularly by the 1920s, and especially with the arrival of the great South American sides of the era, particularly Uruguay, who won in 1924 and 1928, and really mesmerised the large crowds which went to watch them in Paris and Amsterdam. And these are, in effect, the first two World Cups, and that's kind of really acknowledged now by FIFA, which allows Uruguay to sport the four stars on their badge, you know, to indicate four World Cup wins. So really the 1930 tournament was a continuation of these kind of early global and international sporting interactions.
So Uruguay 1930, the inaugural competition, but the next two competitions were held in Europe, and those tournaments a mirror to a continent in the grips of the rise of fascism. Sports Hour's Manny Jasmi has been looking back at those tournaments.
Just to make sure that everyone was clear on exactly who was responsible for this sporting extravaganza, the World Cup organising committee, with heavy Italian representation, introduced La Coppa del Duce. Moulded in bronze and six times bigger than the World Cup trophy, this prize was supplied on behalf of El Duce himself, Mussolini. But Italy's path through the tournament wasn't easy. In the quarterfinal, they played Spain. A goal by Giuseppe Meazza proved enough to win, and Italy met the so-called Wunder Team of Austria in the semi-final. It's alleged that on the night before the match, Mussolini invited the young Swedish referee Ivan Ekland round for dinner. Italy won, and until his death in 2001, Josef Pichan, a member of that Austrian side, was convinced that Ekland had been bought.
The referee even played for them. When I passed the ball out to the right wing, one of our players, Čišek, he ran for it, and the referee headed it back to the Italians. It was terrible. It was unbelievable.
Ekland is the only referee ever to have officiated in the World Cup semi-final and final. Before kick-off in Rome's National Fascist Party Stadium, Mussolini invited him again, this time up to the box of honour. Italy beat Czechoslovakia 2-1 and, with nationalistic coach Vittorio Pozzo at the helm, became emperors of football.
Viva Italia! Viva Mussolini!
The start of Italy's 1938 World Cup could not have been more different from the climax of the previous tournament 4 years earlier. Scenes of strutting fascist celebrations in Rome were replaced by jeering anti-fascist demonstrations in France. In the first round, Italy squeezed past Norway in the strongly anti-fascist city of Marseille. Before kick-off, the Azzurri's trademark fascist salute was greeted with such hostility by the crowd that the team's belligerent coach, Vittorio Pozzo, told the players to repeat the gesture.
At the salute, as predicted, we were greeted by a solemn and deafening barrage of whistles and insults. We had just put down our hands when the violent demonstration started again. Straight away I said, "Team, be ready. Salute." And we raised our hands again to show we had no fear. Having won the battle of intimidation, we played.
And it was this team which met France in a hugely symbolic and portentous quarterfinal in Paris. Because both sides played in blue, there was a toss to see which team would have to change shirts. Italy lost and were forced to wear something other than blue. They wore black. The Azzurri, or blues, had become the Maglia Neri, or black shirts. Fino Fini is director of the Football Museum in Florence.
The reason for the black shirts is very simple. The General Secretary of the Fascist Party, Starace, he suggested to Mussolini that as a slap in the face to the French, let's have the national team play in black shirts. And Mussolini said, "Let's do it, let's do it." So it was decided they should wear black.
So Mussolini's black shirts marched into Paris in the name of football. And thanks to two goals by Piola, were victorious 3-1. Almost exactly 2 years later, Italy declared war on France. Italy went back to Marseille, where they played Brazil in the semi-finals. Strangely, an overconfident Brazil rested the tournament's top scorer, Leonidas da Silva, and Italy won. So Italy, supported by no one in France, had again reached the final. They beat Hungary 4-2 to once again be crowned world champions and finally made some friends. The team returned home by train. Piero Rava was Italy's World Cup winning left back in 1938. 2 years earlier, he was part of the team that won Olympic gold in football in the Berlin Olympics. He was personally presented with his medal by Adolf Hitler. His son-in-law, Mario Parodi, wrote his biography and says for Rava, it was a special homecoming.
He loved to talk to me about that. The return was by train from Paris. Before reaching Rome, the train stopped at Porta Susa, the train station here in Turin. The station master was Rava's father, and he stopped the train to celebrate the World Cup victory personally. The people of Turin, who knew that the train was passing through, went to greet the world champions, especially Rava and Alfredo Foni, who hailed from Turin. Then Rava's father hugged his Piero, and the train left for Rome, where Mussolini was waiting for them.
But here, the World Cup would have to take a break, for Europe's armies were mustering, and Piero Rava's next journey would be to fight in the Second World War.
Manny Jasmi, Professor Matthew Taylor still with me. And Matthew, did the World Cup really have that much of an impact in the 30s?
I think actually its impact was relatively limited and quite muted. I mean, it was clearly, as we've heard, very significant for the host nations and for the teams that won. But the context of the world had changed in the 1930s. This was a decade of economic depression, in many ways kind of deglobalisation. So many of the communication networks and the economic networks which had been forged through the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century were beginning to break down in this period. This was a much more fractured world than when the Olympics was established. And the World Cup was fractured too. I mean, in 1930, only four European teams went to Uruguay. The South Americans weren't keen to attend the European World Cups in 34 and 38. Only Egypt in 1934 and the Dutch East Indies in 1938, outside these kind of big blocks, competed. It was nothing like the major event that it became after the Second World War.
Well, the World Cup then took a break during the Second World War and was next held in Brazil in 1950. And as the author David Goldblatt explains, it's an important moment for the country and how the rest of the world perceived it.
While the rest of the world has been kind of destroying itself during the Second World War, Brazil has been rather blissfully unaware of it and able in that era to industrialise, to urbanise and to develop. And so the 1950 World Cup was seen as an opportunity, much like today's 2014 World Cup, to tell the world how Brazil had been transformed. And in that case, it was the opportunity to say, we have arrived as a modern nation and our footballing prowess is one of the best ways of expressing that and telling you about it. The problem is, of course, is that once you hitch your banner to football, it's a very uncertain game with uncertain outcomes. And so in 1950, in the final, Brazil lose 2-1 to Uruguay. And it's interpreted on that occasion not as a national triumph, but as a complete national disaster. Indeed, evidence of the kind of backwardness and limits of Brazilian development.
And with that defeat in the final, Brazil looked for a scapegoat, as writer Alex Bellos explains.
The story of Barbosa is a tale of a man made scapegoat by a nation and never forgiven. He used to always say before he died, poor man, that normally the maximum sentence in Brazil is 30 years, but he got 50. He was never allowed to forget. There was one occasion, apparently, when he was in the supermarket and he overheard a woman who was probably not even born in 1950 tell her child, "See the man over there? That's the man that made Brazil cry."
In the street where I used to live in Ramos, north area of Rio, it was kind of ordinary neighborhood with very simple people. The main avenue was ready for a big party with long tables all around with all sorts of food and drinks, anything you could think of. Everything was covered with Brazilian flags. When I came back from Maracanã after the game, it was drizzling. And when we got to the avenue, there was nobody there, just desolation. The most incredible thing is that there were 8 or 10 stray dogs just looking to the feast. Even then, did not feel like eating on that day.
The story of the 1950 Brazil goalkeeper and scapegoat Barbosa. Matt Taylor, does this World Cup mark the start of the cultural significance of the tournament for South America?
Oddly enough, it was the next three or four tournaments, particularly the tournaments in 54, 58 and 62, which are sometimes called the Small World Cups because they were played in relatively small footballing nations. And in the case of Sweden, 58, very small stadiums. I think they were a particular turning point for a number of reasons. I mean, 1958, for instance, heralded the arrival of this great Brazilian team, the Brazilian side, which went on to be very successful in 62 and 70, of Pelé and Garrincha. It also marked significantly, I think, the first time a nation had won the World Cup from outside its own continent. And that was really very important. The idea that this was something that you could travel and you could possibly win. And the Brazilians have prepared themselves very well to do that. They'd been in Europe for some time touring and they were very well prepared. Also, really significantly, it marked the beginning, I think, of the arrival of television significantly as a crucial way of bringing the stories, narratives and dramas, I suppose, of the World Cup closer to people who were located all over the world. That was really significant. And there were all sorts of other important sort of stories in 1958 in particular. The first appearance of the Soviet Union occurred in 1958. And it wasn't just for Brazil, for Argentina, the memory that the Brazilian people have of 1950 was in some ways repeated for the Argentinians in 1958. The Argentinians went expecting to have a very good chance of winning the tournament. They'd beaten Brazil shortly before. They considered themselves one of the best nations in the world, and they had a disastrous tournament. The World Cup, and in certain cases, wanting to improve upon failures and disasters and you know, really make your name on a global stage. The World Cup really mattered to them by this point.
Well, we'll talk more about South America in just a moment. This is Sports Hour on the BBC World Service as we continue our look at the most significant World Cup moments in history. The 1974 competition was played at the height of the Cold War and right on its front line, West Germany, with East Germany taking part too. And Matt, how significant has the World Cup been in creating Germany's national identity?
Well, I think you could argue that more than any other nation, West Germany and Germany has helped to define its national identity in relation to the World Cup. This happened initially in 1954 when the West Germans surprisingly beat the Hungarians, who were the great team of the day, in the miracle of Bern. That indicated the arrival of the West Germans kind of in the international community relatively shortly after the Second World War. It happened again in 1990 when a reunified German team were kind of successful in, you know, reflecting a new Germany in many ways. The 74 World Cup, some people have said, was the least kind of nationalistic and the one least linked to national identity in certain respects. But we have to remember it came very shortly after the 1972 Munich Olympics, which had been eclipsed by the international terrorism which took place. And so 74 was a way of kind of making up for that in certain respects in terms of, you know, the increased security. You know, we can put on an international event despite this. And I think It did, although the crowds may not have been as enthusiastic, apparently it was the wettest World Cup in record as well, which people think kind of affected the crowds at that particular tournament. But I think it did have a really significant cultural legacy in West Germany.
To 1978 next, and the World Cup hosted once again in South America, with hosts Argentina the winners. A bittersweet victory for a country under military rule. Manny Jasmi reports.
The 1978 World Cup was as much about propaganda as it was football. Like Italy's fascist leader Benito Mussolini in 1934, Argentina's military government used their hosting of the tournament to showcase the country. Colour television was introduced for the first time, gleaming football stadia were built, and a public relations firm from New York was brought in to sell the country to the world. But the junta needed the World Cup to distract attention from what it hoped would remain an horrific secret. Normally, after someone was arrested, the authorities used their address books to round up their friends and associates as well. But whether by coincidence or design, the junta got its way, and the disappearances remained in the background of Argentine life. But for people like Anna McHugh, the disappearances were most definitely real. Anna was arrested because of her previous involvement with the left-wing Peronist youth movement during the time before the installation of military rule. Only she was one of the lucky ones who came back. This is her story, told in 1978.
All of the guys have been tortured, and I've seen marks of cigarettes burned in the skin, and some of them have been raped several times. While I was there one night, one girl came, was brought there. She was unconscious for several hours, and when she came round, she said that she had been tortured and they were going to torture her again till she told them where her boyfriend was. One night she was taken out again and we didn't see her anymore.
Argentina in possession on the far side of the field.
On the field, Argentina lost to Italy in the first round. But they made it through to the semi-final group, a mini-league of four teams, the winner of which would play in the final. Going into the last matches of the league, the only team who could deprive Argentina of a place in the final was their old enemy, Brazil. Argentina were playing Peru, while the Brazilians faced Poland, but not at the same time. Brazil beat Poland in the afternoon, meaning that Argentina, who didn't kick off until that evening, knew exactly what they had to do to reach the final. Thrash an impressive Peruvian side by at least four clear goals.
Here they go forward again. Luque inside the penalty area. That's six! Luque! 6-0! Nothing can stop them now!
So it was that Argentina, and not Brazil, made it to the World Cup final of 1978 in the River Plate Stadium, where they met Holland. And amid the snowstorm of blue and white confetti, the junta's aim of legitimising itself in the eyes of the world had apparently succeeded even before kick-off, thanks to some very high-level American support.
And also in the VIP box, one of the world's now most recognisable football fans. He seems to turn up at World Cups and European events as well. Henry Kissinger of the United States.
Led by the galloping centre-forward Mario Kempes, Argentina won 3-1 after extra time, sparking delirium on the streets. The architect of Argentina's success was their socialist, chain-smoking coach, Cesar Menotti. In fact, Menotti was an outspoken critic of the regime, as midfielder Ozzy Ardiles recalls.
Menotti was very critical of the junta, of the military, very, very critical. And given a little chance, the junta would have done something against Menotti, but they couldn't because the team was playing very well and Menotti was indispensable.
Por su capitán, Daniel Passarella.
There's no doubt that staging and winning the World Cup did legitimise Argentina's ruthless dictatorship. The same men who summarily murdered and kidnapped hundreds of people a day were seen by some, not least FIFA, as being friends of football. But Ozzy Ardiles is in no doubt that his World Cup winner's medal is not tainted.
From my point of view, we were doing what we had to do. We do it for Argentina. We didn't want to do it for the junta or for any government, not for any color, right-winger, left-winger. We did it because this is our job. We wanted to be the best in the world. And in fact, we did it for the Argentinian people, all the people that suffered tremendously through all this period.
Manny Jasmi there. And Matt, we've had subsequent World Cups in North America, Asia, Africa. In terms of soft power, is anything more influential than the World Cup, even the Olympics?
Certainly, as the World Cup has become increasingly kind of big in terms of its financial status and the audiences, the global audiences it can reach, to host a World Cup is extremely important as an acknowledgement of all sorts of things, a modernisation, the re-emergence in the international community that's happened in many ways. I think prior probably to the 1980s, 1990s, the World Cup was a bit too small to rival the Olympics in that sense. More recently, though, I certainly think you could argue that the staging of mega events, you know, World Cups and Olympics, have become almost entirely focuses for emerging powers and crucial for emerging powers. The last World Cup and the upcoming World Cup in 2010 in South Africa and this one in Brazil, which of course will be followed by an Olympics in 2 years' time. I think they're all examples of this. They signal the arrival of a nation into the international community, a kind of shift also in all these cases from a kind of regional to global power. So I think sport, and particularly mega events like the Olympics and the World Cup, are absolutely crucial for kind of cultural forms of soft power nowadays.
And crucial for giving us some incredible tales as well. Wish we had longer with you, Matt, but thank you very much for joining us. We've a World Cup to get to, so we better let you go. That's Professor Matt Taylor, Acting Director of the International Centre for Sports History and Culture at De Montfort University.
The BBC World Service.
Share the experience with the world.
from the teams and the players.
I'm Lee James, and we'll be bringing you a daily roundup of all the World Cup results and reaction.
The cities and the fans.
Ben James here, and Brazil Today is the daily interactive show where we'll discuss the day's talking points.
To the news and the stories.
I'm James Menendez, and every day we'll bring you the people, the sights and the sounds of Brazil.
Throughout the month of the tournament, we'll be where the action is, in Brazil.
We'll bring you all the excitement surrounding one of the world's greatest sporting occasions, the decisive moments of the tournament, and the chance for you to have your say.
Share the experience with the world on the BBC.
This is Sports Hour, living the story through sport. Coming up, Elsa Hammond about to set off on a solo rowing race to Hawaii. But although she'll have no one to help her row, she'll have 2,400 women to keep her company. All will be explained. Plus, sporting witness hears from tennis champion Michael Chang, 25 years on from his French Open victory as the tanks rolled into Tiananmen Square. Sports Hour continues after the BBC News.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, has pledged the country's future to Europe and said Crimea, which Russia annexed in March, would always be part of Ukraine. After a swearing-in ceremony in Kiev, Mr. Poroshenko said he would work towards making Ukraine a full member of the European Union. The billionaire confectionery tycoon laid out steps to end the crisis in Ukraine, saying he did not want war or revenge. Police in Brazil have fired tear gas at protesters on the second day of a metro strike that has left Sao Paulo's transport in chaos. There was gridlock on the streets of the city, which will host the opening match of the Football World Cup next week. Officials in Afghanistan say more than 50 people have been killed in flash flooding in the remote mountainous northeast of the country. Dozens are still missing after torrential rains. An anti-corruption investigation in China has revealed that more than 1,000 officials in Guangdong province have wives or children living abroad. China's communist leadership is trying to stamp out the practice in the belief that it's linked to corruption. Many officials funnel illegally obtained funds to relatives outside the country. Rising sea levels around the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean have washed the remains of Second World War soldiers from their graves. The island's foreign minister said high tides had exposed the skeletons of 26 people. Thailand's military rulers have lifted a curfew at four tourist destinations to encourage foreigners to continue visiting the country despite political uncertainty. The ruling means that famous all-night parties on the southern island of Pangan will again take place this month. And the American CIA has opened accounts on Twitter and Facebook, saying it wants to engage more directly with the public. The spy agency's first message on Twitter says, "We can neither confirm nor deny that this is our first tweet." BBC News.
And you're listening to Sports Hour with me, Caroline Barker, living the story through sport. And still to come, we'll head to Japan, where traditionalists are trying to tackle a weighty issue affecting sumo wrestling. But first, the lengths that some people will go to avoid football's World Cup. Weather permitting, Elsa Hammond will set off this week on what many might consider a terrifying challenge, getting into a rowing boat and crossing an ocean alone. She's hoping to become the youngest and fastest woman to cross from California to Hawaii. And she started our chat by telling me about the 2,400 women she's honouring on her journey.
It came about in a number of different ways, partly thinking about how to get more people involved. And also, the more I've been doing it, the more I've been sort of aware of how this is still quite a male-dominated area. In this race, actually, there are quite a few women, but still fewer than men, and still I think there's an expectation of being sort of quite a big muscled Bear Grylls character. And I just wanted to use this as an opportunity to celebrate women who've been inspirational as well. I'm going to have all those stories, all those dedications printed out or sent to me, and each day as I row those miles, I'll read about the people whose miles I've rowed, and it feels like really being surrounded by so many different people.
You mentioned the role of women, particularly in sport as well. So you still feel that, I mean, this is plenty of physical barriers that you'll be going through, but you also feel you're challenging some of those ideas.
Yes, I think so. My partner's been sort of asked at times, if he's happy to let me go, and are you happy letting her go like that? Which is not something that would get asked in the same way the other way, I think.
Well, you should say, I'm not on my own. I've got these 2,400
yeah,
women with me.
Absolutely.
Is it also partly as well because of a lack of sponsorship on the boat? I mean, that's normally where you see these big brands, these big corporate names splayed down the side of the boat.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's something that is a huge challenge, really, really big challenge. I mean, certainly in kind of pure sport, that's still a hugely gendered thing, partly because coverage is still much less readily available in women's sport, and in women's sport is far less well sponsored.
So what will be the tough points of this journey? Will it be being on your own?
I'm sure it will, although when I first heard about ocean rowing, I've always imagined doing it by myself. For me, part of the lure and the challenge is the solo journey as well. I've thought about it a lot, and I've spent a lot of time preparing and talking to people and talking through ways of dealing with that. But I'm really interested to see how that plays out, actually, that side of it. I think the mental side of things will certainly be a bigger challenge in a number of different ways than the physical side of things, not just the isolation, but also just the stress of dealing with big storms and things that I may find really scary.
We've spoken about the physical and the mental training that you've put in, and then just the logistical stuff, I guess, Elsa, the provisions, everything that you have to take with you because you are alone.
Yes, absolutely. So it's a solo and unsupported journey. So when I row out of Monterey Bay, I have to have everything on board that I will need. I'm packing between 4,500 and 8,000 calories a day. I think it'll be a lot to eat, especially in the first few days, first week, when I'll be feeling seasick and exhausted and new to it. I'll probably really struggle with that, but it should mean that I don't lose too much weight on the trip, and that I'm putting back in the calories that I'm burning.
At least you'll get quicker as you get nearer the end, yes, as there's less weight on it.
Absolutely.
What's the biggest worry for you, Elsa?
I don't know. I suppose a few things. I mean, I've got little kind of niggling worries about things like sharks that really shouldn't be an issue. And sort of some people just think that's really comical because it's so much more unlikely than something like shipping, which is actually a realistic worry. I think the first of everything, so the first big storm and the first few nights at sea in the dark by myself with this very, very deep ocean, I suppose also just the keeping going, the boredom, because a lot of it will be hugely boring, just rowing for days on end, and just trusting that I will be able to keep going, which I know I will, but I know I need to also kind of be mentally strong to make sure that I do.
Which begs the question, why do it at all, Elsa? You know, all these elements that you'll be up against, all these fears that you'll have to break as well.
Oh, I think that makes you feel really alive, though, all of that. It's a challenge that I've just wanted to do for a long time, and it's really hard to explain. When I first heard of ocean rowing, I just thought, I want to do that one day, and I haven't been able to let it go. It's been about 8 years now that it's been tapping away inside, so I've sort of allowed myself to go for it finally. I think it's the challenge. I think it's the extremes. I think it also appeals to me, sort of being on this little boat and having everything I need with me.
And in that, I guess, you'll have a mini TV with you so you can watch the World Cup as you go?
Well, unfortunately, I might not be able to.
See, here's me thinking that would be your first concern.
I'm sure I can get updates if I feel like I need them.
And you can keep a track on Elsa's progress, maybe help her with that boredom, on her website, details of which can be found on our Sports Hour page. Just head to bbcworldservice.com. Now, 5 years ago, Sara Byers was unfit and overweight. Today, though, she's poised to travel to the Commonwealth Games as part of the Canadian track cycling team. All the more remarkable considering a lack of funding means Sara has to fit in training around a full-time job. Now, at 35, an age when most cyclists are retiring, she's got one last chance to beat the necessary qualifying time. The BBC's Mark Beaumont has been to meet Sara and her husband as she prepares for the biggest race of her life.
Canada have been one of the most successful nations at the Commonwealth Games, and I'll be sending one of the biggest teams to Glasgow 2014. But one area that they have struggled to get the same success as the likes of Australia and England is track cycling.
Sara Byers is an assistant curator at the Niagara Falls History Museum. She didn't take up cycling until her 30th birthday, and just 5 years later, she hopes to represent Canada at Glasgow 2014.
Well, it started as a way to lose weight, I think. I was approaching my 30th birthday, and I was very unfit and not feeling very good about myself. I got on a spin bike first, and people said, wow, you're strong. You got to get on a real bike. So I got on a real bike and then just got stronger and found a competitive side.
So I guess most of your competitors are in the velodrome, and you're right here on your own in the cold, in the wind. That's going to make it a bit more challenging.
Yeah, it sure does. It makes me tougher.
The long cold winters and the lack of indoor training facilities pose a real problem for all Canadian cyclists.
I drive to London, Ontario, which is a couple of hours away, and that's where I do, yeah, the on-the-track stuff, which is still a little different because to set the times and what I would be competing on for something like Commonwealth Games is a full-size, it's a world-class track. It's bigger.
At the age of 35, when most national cyclists are retiring from the sport, Sarah is still improving and on the brink of qualifying for the team.
A lot of sport programs are for younger athletes. They have a full career ahead of them. A lot of time for development where maybe I don't. Like, nobody knows, right? If I'm at the end of my career, they don't really know where I'm coming from. So I often find that I have to maybe explain a little bit more or prove that I'm up to it and that I'm in it for the long haul.
Since starting racing, Sarah met and married her coach, David Jack. He looks after her bikes, sets up her training programs, and helps to fundraise for equipment and travel.
She found a system that she was able to, you know, sort of spread the word through social media. And, you know, it's kind of really neat because, you know, people that she's never even met were contributing.
The coming weeks are crucial for Sarah to qualify for the Commonwealth Games. This would complete her incredible transformation from being out of shape to racing for her country.
I hope that people can identify with what I have done and that they, you know, believe that they can do it too. And that's something that I try to talk to people about, is that, you know, I it's just me. I'm just a regular person and was able to define a goal and find a path to it.
There's inspiration for you. And you can see Sarah on her bike on the BBC website, bbcworldservice.com. You're listening to Sports Hour. It's 9:41 GMT. Still to come.
Out of the blue, he says, you have nothing to hurt me. He says, you better work on it. And so I was kind of like, okay, thanks, you know?
You're listening to Sports Hour on the BBC World Service. Now, with more and more women taking part in sport, the focus of medical researchers around the world is shifting, and they've begun to discover some interesting differences between the genders. One such finding is that women are up to 8 times more likely to suffer anterior cruciate ligament or ACL injuries. Our reporter Caroline Rigby's been looking into this, and what have you found?
Yeah, there are all sorts of reasons why people get hurt playing sport, and it appears some injuries are far more likely to happen to women than men, and that could be down to something as simple as physiology. As Professor Caroline Finch, the head of the Australian Centre for Research in Injury and Sport and its Prevention, explained to me.
If you think about men, they tend to have small hips and very sort of square lines, whereas women have got broader hips, so our legs are angled in. And that puts different pressure on the knees. So when people jump up to shoot a goal, say in basketball, we land on the ground and we take up impact forces through our feet and our knees are slightly bent. In men, because they've got narrow hips, straight up and down alignment, they tend to get less injuries than women because we've got the angles and the forces aren't so dissipated.
Well, that kind of insight allows athletes to prepare far better to avoid injury. And for instance, in training, they can focus on strengthening key muscles. But Professor Finch says other factors such as hormones also come into play.
They affect the ligaments and tendons in the body. And so at different times of the month, these structures within the body might be more or less elastic. When things are more elastic, they can probably put up with different tolerances of strains and forces than when they're tight. So it's really just a matter of really making sure that the actions that are required of our females are really appropriate and not pushing them to the same physical limits at the time when they might be hormonally challenged.
Of course, these factors are far more difficult to rectify, but Dr. Finch says coaches could consider women's cycles when developing training plans for individual athletes and even when deciding on who makes the starting lineup of a team.
And it seems that research into this area is still at a very early stage, but certain sports governing bodies are more aware of this issue.
Yeah, and I think that's largely down to participation levels. Take Australian rules football. The number of women and girls taking part in that sport has ballooned in recent years to 175,000. And because of this, the Australian Football League, or AFL, has commissioned research into female athletes to build a better profile of injuries among their players. Jan Cooper is the AFL's National Manager for Female Football Development.
We need to be able to give some education to our coaches. Are they aware of these nuances with their female athletes? Because a lot of our coaches are males. Do they provide preventative warm-up activities or cool-downs that make sure that female athletes are provided the best possible player welfare in playing Australian football? We need this research sooner rather than later so that we can give our players the best possible experience and the safest possible experience.
So when are we likely to see any lessons that have been learnt from this study put into practice?
Well, over the course of the season, researchers will be assessing several hundred women, and we can expect to see the results in time for next year's pre-season training, which begins in January. But the findings will benefit more than simply elite sports. It's about broadening our knowledge to help prevent injuries in everyone, as Dr. Finch explains.
We want people to play sport